Guidance.
Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke. This is the March 23rd, 2013 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, beautiful afternoon. Lots going on along the Space Coast today, including the air show up at Space Coast Airport. They still have a tower working, at least for now. Welcome aboard, everyone, as we do begin another hour of discussion about our space program. And when we say we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of space, that is especially true today. In just a moment, we're going to be joined briefly by Lee Solid, who is one of the great legends of space here at the Cape. And then a little later on, my special guest will be Eileen Collins, the former NASA astronaut who served as the first female pilot and then first commander, female that is, of a space shuttle mission. We'll also update you on the latest plans for the next launch from Cape Canaveral. And of course, if you'd like to join us on the program today, you can do so by dialing 321-768-1240 or do it by sending us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. I want to start off the program today by once again congratulating United Launch Alliance and the Air Force for pulling off another successful launch this past week when an Atlas V inserted a new missile warning satellite into Earth orbit. The weather cooperated, the hardware behaved, and we saw yet another on-time launch as the Atlas V continues to impress, now with 37 good launches in a row during the past decade. And I also want to congratulate Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, and his underwater salvage team for their efforts in recovering pieces of several F1 rocket engines from the Atlantic Ocean this past week. Bezos hopes to put the recovered hardware on display for the entire world to see. And with that in mind, if you don't know much about the F1, then I encourage you to listen up. We're going to be joined here now by Lee Solid, who worked on the engine during the Apollo program. And every time we talk with Lee, I am once again reminded about how astounded I am that a fan of the Green Bay Packers can also be a rocket scientist. Lee Solid, welcome to the program this afternoon. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Much better than the Packers.
And sorry about your loss of Greg Jennings to the Vikings this week. We could spend some time talking about that. Your engines were in the news this week, and I know you had a chance to go out and see the hardware, at least you were planning to. Did you get a chance to see the ships come back yesterday?
I did, and I was invited to view the hardware, and I did that. And so I spent about an hour on the deck of Bezos Expeditions ship, and I was amazed. I couldn't they asked me, when was the last time I saw that hardware? I had to scratch my head and think back, but it probably was in early 1969 when those stages started arriving here.
Sure.
And we did our thing. We, being the Rocketdyne launch operations crew, did our thing on preparing those engines for launch, and that would have been the last time I saw that hardware.
Anything recognizable to you, Lee? I mean, it was hard to tell from the photos that I saw what was what.
Well, yes. You know, it's the turbo pumps were easily recognizable because they were pretty much intact. Anything that was in the mud was highly corroded because the mud is so acidic down there. But,
sure.
You know, the injector, the dome and the injector looked beautiful. The combustion zone, combustion chamber, of course, it was cut off just below the throat. The thrust chambers were largely just stacks of tubes. And so you really could not have, if you weren't, you know, really familiar with the hardware, you couldn't have looked at that and said, yeah, that's A.
Right. And I know Jeff was talking in some of the media reports and some of his tweets and reports online that it was going to be hard to identify what hardware went with what mission. I mean, some of the headlines around the nation proclaimed this was Apollo 11 engines recovered. I mean, you don't know whether it was Apollo 4 or Apollo 17.
Well, right. Now, they did recover this hardware in the zone where, by trajectory analysis, that's where it would have landed. Of course, you know, how far does it drift as it's going down through 2.5 miles of ocean?
Water, sure.
My involvement in it from the very beginning was to help them identify the hardware. So I was able to tell them where all the nameplates and part numbers and serial numbers were. The part in the whole thing that's missing, and Jeff Bezos made a one-liner comment about the confusion associated with identifying the hardware. The confusion comes in, and you can read some part numbers and serial numbers, but we don't have the configuration management data packs that actually said, hey, valve part number such and such, serial number such and such was ultimately flown on engines such and such.
Sure.
And so that's where the confusion comes in. I would guess that of the four, and I know there's some question about how many engines worth of hardware did he bring back, but it's around four engines worth. I would guess that two of those are Apollo 11 engines.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, we talk about the F1, and just for the sort of the non-space crowd that doesn't intimately know what that is, talk about the F1 engine, Lee, and what it was, how big it was, I mean, just how important it was to Apollo.
Well, you know, briefly, the F1, of course, is the largest rocket engine ever developed and built and flown. The Russians can lay claim to one that has a few pounds more thrust, that is the RD-170, but that's a four-barrel.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that comes close to the single-engine F-1, which had over one and a half million pounds of thrust. It was about, you know, 19 feet high as it sat on its extension nozzle. It was a huge machine. It was also a highly reliable machine.
Sure.
We launched that Saturn V 13 times, and every engine worked perfectly. That's 65 engines that worked perfectly. And, you know, so the F-1 engine, it was an incredible machine. And I don't know of anything that even comes close. Now, it wasn't high performing.
Sure.
You know, it had about a specific impulse. For the non-space crowd, that would be like miles per gallon,
right.
But it's really pounds of thrust per pound of propellant, and it was around 260. The RD-180 that goes on the Atlas V, the RD-170 on the Proton and the Sea Launch, you know, are up around 310, so they're much higher performing. But, you know, this was designed to do a job, and it did that job very well.
That's incredible. Lee, with about 45 seconds left, what are your thoughts on resurrecting the F-1? I guess there's some talks about the F-1B being used on Space Launch System. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think it's a good idea. I know that they're looking at an F-1. In fact, you know, a note of interest, one of the engines that was slated for Apollo 11 was installed in the stage and then taken out. That is the engine that ultimately went to the Smithsonian. And that hardware now, some of that hardware has been brought back to Marshall, and they've been doing some tests on it. I think they've had a couple of tests so far.
Yeah.
And it's all part of that liquid strap-on booster for the Space Launch System. You know, at least it's a designed engine. You know what it can do. It's it would save incredible development costs to try to, you know, make something new. And, you know, you just want something that's going to get a mass
And Lee, with that, we really appreciate it. We're going to be back in just a few seconds with Eileen Collins. Lee Solid, thanks for joining us today. F-1 engine, awful darn cool. All that and more coming up here on Space Talk. I'm Jim Behnke. This is WMMB.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back, everyone, to Space Talk. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Again, my thanks in the first segment to Lee Solid for joining us for a few moments to talk about the Saturn F1 engines, some of which were recovered from the ocean this past week. I think that was a really neat thing, and it just reminds me that there's other hardware out there, not the least of which is a third stage of a Saturn V sitting in solar orbit, and other neat things that are out there that one day we can go get, and I hope we do. Okay, this is going to be fun now, too, because one of my favorite people in the space business is my next guest right now. I first met Eileen Collins not too long after she was selected as an astronaut candidate in 1992, when she was assigned to the Cape here and took a turn at a Meet the Astronaut night in Cocoa Beach, long before she became probably the closest thing we think we've ever had to a household name of an astronaut during the shuttle era. And because she is a native of Elmira, New York, which is the home of one of our Gannett papers, of course, you know, Florida Today is a Gannett paper. During her first flight in 1996, Todd Halverson at Florida Today and myself and others were very involved in helping their Elmira newspaper folks cover their hometown hero. Anyway, when we think of Eileen Collins, we have a lot of good memories. After flying three times in space, once as pilot, twice as commander, including the first mission following the loss of Columbia and crew, Eileen retired from NASA in 2006. She stayed busy ever since. And now this year, incredibly, she's coming back to the Kennedy Space Center next month to be inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame. Eileen, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
Hi. Well, thanks for having me. I'm doing great, and you're way too kind.
Well, let's talk about the big news locally. You've been inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame, or are about to be, coming down here for all the festivities about, what, 4 weeks from this weekend, I think.
I think it's on the 20th.
Yeah. Who gave you the news, and what was your reaction?
Well, Dan Brandenstein called me, and Dan was the chief of the astronaut office back when I was a newly selected astronaut and an astronaut candidate. So it was great to have Dan call. I was quite surprised to hear him on the phone. Couldn't imagine what he would be calling me, a voice from the past.
Yeah, really.
And he broke the news.
And sometimes when the chief astronaut calls, it's not always good news, you know? Well, tell us this. Let's go back to the beginning and take this chronologically. Tell us the story. Remind us, how does someone growing up in Elmira, which is a relatively nice small town, I should say not relatively nice. It is a small, relatively nice. No, what am I trying to say? A relatively small, nice town. How do you get interested in aviation and space and wind up doing what you did when you grow up in that environment?
Well, you got it right. It is a relatively small town, a nice place, a great place to raise a family. And back when I was a kid, actually even today, Elmira and the surrounding area is the home of the National Soaring Museum.
Right.
And also the National Warbird Museum, which is now the Wings of Eagles Discovery Center. So it's and Glenn Curtis flew his first aircraft up in the Finger Lakes, not too far from Elmira. I went to summer camp, watched the gliders flying overhead. My dad took us to the airport. Just very simple A&W root beer, sit on the hood of the car, watch yeah. airplanes take off. That was really, you know, I my family did not have the money, not even close, to give me flying lessons.
Right.
Not, I mean, it wasn't even, I didn't even think about asking my parents. You know, we had been on food stamps, we had been on welfare, my parents had been ill on and off, and I thought, I'm going to do this on my own someday. And I think the roots of the space program, the Gemini program, back when I was in elementary school, mm-hmm. was part of the fuel that made me more interested in being a pilot. I wanted to be a test pilot. I wanted to go farther, faster, and higher. I still get excited thinking about it. Flying is just in my blood. But, you know, for the young people out there listening, you don't have to have a lot of money to be a pilot or to go on and be an astronaut. I was 20 years old when I finally had enough money saved up in my bank account to buy my own flying lessons.
Wow.
And there was nothing that was going to stop me. Even the fact that I was a young woman felt like this was a man's world and I didn't really fit in. It took a lot of courage for me to go up to the airport and ask for my first flying lessons, but something inside of me made me do it. And here I am.
And here you are. And so you progressed through your military career and you wound up being an astronaut. And at a time when, of course, the story about, the angle that, being first female pilot, first female shuttle commander, I mean, that's obviously a huge part of your story. you come into the astronaut office as one of the first hired as pilot commander material as opposed to a mission specialist. Was there anything different? I mean, was the reception warm? Was there any kind of strangeness for anybody in that scenario when you joined way back in, 92?
Well, I actually interviewed in 1989, and I should tell you that I interviewed as a mission specialist. So a lot of people don't realize that I applied as both a pilot and mission specialist, but because I had not yet graduated from the Air Force Test Pilot School, the Air Force forwarded my name only as a mission specialist.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
I interviewed, and that kept it pretty low-key. I was the only woman that year that that was eligible to be a pilot. So the selection board asked me not once but four times during the interview if I would rather be a pilot. And I stuck to my first answer, which was, I will do either pilot or mission specialist. I want to be part of the space program.
Be part of the team, absolutely.
And really, I don't think I really answered your question. The reception was very good. I just don't have any complaints, problems. It was very smooth, and I was very welcomed into the program.
Yeah, and I think with the women that had joined the astronaut office by that time, starting with the first group in 78, I've never heard that was a problem or an issue or a stigma in any way. Joanne Morgan here at Kennedy Space Center is so fond of telling the story that when she started way back in the early 60s, there were only male bathrooms, So, I mean, she had to deal with those kind of issues. And, of course, by the time you came along, I'm sure that wasn't the case in the astronaut office. It's interesting, Eileen, I think it's a point that can use some emphasis in that you tried once and didn't make it and you tried again. And I think so many people can still learn from that to try to do something that you want to do. Sometimes you don't get what you want, but you got to keep after it. And I know a lot of astronauts can repeat that story.
Well, I actually applied three times to the Air Force Test Pilot School, and I kept getting bumped for what I call silly reasons, but, history. And then by the time I applied to the astronaut program, I did get picked up on the first selection. But I was a little bit older, I would say, than the average interviewee because it had taken me a while to get into the Air Force Test Pilot School, and that was something that really had to be completed before I was eligible and even competitive to be a shuttle pilot.
Well, let's jump forward a little bit. July 1999, Columbia, you're going to fly your first mission as a commander. You've already flown as a pilot. You've learned all the new responsibilities that it takes to be a commander, and you've executed those, and you're sitting in the cockpit, and the engines ignite. And then what? I mean, I'll never forget that day sitting at the press site, and it was like, all heck broke loose.
It's 5 seconds after liftoff, we had an indication in the cockpit. It was a fuel cell pH, which means something was wrong with the fuel cell. We didn't know at the time that there was a short. AC-1 phase A shorted out. It was a wire back in the payload bay that was kind of rubbing up against the wall, and it broke the current for just a split second. So we lost a few pumps. We had a few alarms going off. Houston called AC bus sensors off. That's just a precautionary step that we took. I honestly thought for a split second that I was in the simulator. Because the last simulator before we went into space, AC-1 phase A failed.
Really?
And yes, and it was just the strangest coincidence that it happened on a flight. But not only did we have the short, and we knew about that all the way uphill, but we, unknown to us, we had a leak in our main propulsion system.
Yeah.
We were leaking out of, I forgot which engine, I think it was the Wright number 3 engine. And we didn't realize until we had an early main engine cutoff by about a second, which put us in a lower orbit. So the ascent was actually much quieter than a typical simulation, but the crew is trained to handle it. And we we're ready to jump on whatever needs to be done and take the next action. You when you are in the launch vehicle, you're very calm. It's amazing how calm and procedural you become. But when I watch a launch, I get very scared.
Yeah.
And when you don't have control over something, you have more of a sense of fear, I think, than when you do have some control.
And Eileen, with about 30 seconds or so before we have to wrap up for our first break, sitting there in the left seat for the first time for that mission, any different feeling to you than sitting in the right seat other than the operational differences?
The sense of responsibility goes up without a doubt, and we had the payload, the Chandra X-ray Observatory. I felt very like it was my baby, and I wanted to take care of that thing.
I can imagine. Well, look, Eileen, why don't you stand by right now for a second, and we're going to take our break here at the bottom of the hour, our five-minute built-in hold, get everybody caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And then when we come back, we'll talk some more with Eileen Collins. A little bit later on, we'll update you on the next launch from the Cape following this week's Atlas V launch. And then we'll wrap up the program with our five questions of terminal count for the one and only Eileen Collins. Everybody stand by right now. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions and comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address spacetalking@AOL.com. If you have a question or comment for me or our guest today, Eileen Collins, who's joining us to talk about, past, present, and future, and we're going to get to the future parts in just a second. Eileen, a couple of things from emails and Facebook posts that I wanted to pass along to you. First of all, Elliot Pullum from the Space Foundation says to say hello to Mom.
And, great.
And Jacques Tuzot, our favorite French, the dean of French aerospace reporting, says that he has some pictures of an event from last fall that he wants to get to you, and I'll send you his contact information. You can deal with it. And then the other question, and it's not coming from anybody in particular that I can tell, at least there's no identification, but it's like everyone wants to ask you what's it like in space type questions. This questioner wants to know what's it like to be a Jeopardy question.
Or I suppose, what's it like to be a Jeopardy question?
Yeah, apparently you were the question to the answer of a Jeopardy category not too long ago. So I was like, did you even know that? I don't want to say that makes you an answer to a trivia question, but
no, I have heard people tell me all the time, and I thought maybe they're watching old reruns, but apparently I have become trivia. So, you know, I've made it. What can I say?
You've made it.
I've made the big time.
You know, well at least, you know, like we say, you're practically a household name in terms of the space shuttle era. Let's talk about some more about your commanding of a mission. You talked about the sense of responsibility that Chandra was your baby. Let's talk about post-Columbia. And remind me, were you already slated to be commander of the next flight after 107, which would have been 114, or did that come along at some point afterwards? I just can't remember.
Yes, actually I was. My crew was with the... When the accident happened, my crew was 5 weeks from launch, and it was myself, Jim Kelly, Steve Robinson, Soichi Noguchi. The three of us were the shuttle crew taking up three station crew members, and of course, our mission, we knew it would delay for several years. At least we knew that kind of in the back of our heads, and we ended up having a major change in what the mission was all about. We added three shuttle crew members and deleted the crew exchange first station. And there was just many, many launch date changes and mission changes, but a very, very difficult period, and one that I don't ever want to forget because there's so many lessons learned from that period.
Did you read some of Wayne Hale's blog recently about his memories of Columbia?
Well, I do read his blog once in a while. I haven't been there recently, but I do think that that's a good thing for people to look at, because I think that Wayne has a lot of very good reflections and very good lessons learned that you know, that doesn't just apply to the space program. Sure. Those ideas apply to, I don't care what job you have, and they even apply to your family life, these lessons learned from the accident, and how to really be a better listener. Humility is an important thing in the space program, that we can drop our I-know-it-all type attitude. You might be the smartest guy in the room, but maybe somebody else knows something you don't know. And just the idea of creativity, and not just innovation, but every day being a creative thinker in how you look at things. Yes, a piece of foam actually could, going fast enough, put a hole in a heat shield.
Yeah.
And there's just, we have to question everything that we hear. And I think that Wayne, I'm not repeating anything that he's saying, but I think I'm just kind of giving my ideas. But I think Wayne's got some great ideas there. And what can I say? He's been doing it for a long time, and God bless him.
Yeah, really. You know, obviously a very difficult time, obviously emotionally, and we all lived through that, and we don't need to dwell on that. But in terms of your role, Eileen, as a commander of this mission that's going through these changes, going through personnel changes, having all these additional procedures and safety things added on to it, all for good reason. But it just seems to me, I mean, how did you keep your head together? I remember we were talking together once in Houston, and, you know, you were just, it was a mile a minute. The days were long.
Well, there are techniques that I was very conscious that I was using. One of them is a sense of control. I'm one of those people that likes to have control of things going around me. I knew after the accident I had to just drop it. I did not have control of much of anything after the accident. And I had to really move into the listen mode, move into the helper mode, look around, where is the help needed. I was really working the return to flight, but there was really not much structure initially.
Mm-hmm.
Kent Rominger, who was the chief of the astronaut office, did a fabulous job, by the way. He asked me if I would be, is one of my jobs, if I would be a media spokesperson, and there were, I think, four or five of us that did that. And I was a little bit, I'm like, are you sure you want me to do this?
Right.
I was a little bit leery of taking on that job, but I found that because of the way, I was a good person for that because of the way I was working and trying to stay in touch with the return to flight, not really as much of the accident investigation.
Right.
But it was a very difficult period, and your listeners can think the difficult periods in their life. Sometimes you just have to think about, I don't have control over all this. I really need to reach out to my faith and to the people I work with, and to, you know, you got to really draw from the people around you that are experts in their area and rely on them. And I'll tell you that having gone through that period of the accident really changed me. It made me a better commander.
Yeah.
It made me a better listener, I think.
Yeah, and as you're going through that, I was just curious myself, you know, as a return-to-flight mission, we've had two return-to-flight missions, so a lot of times we try to make comparisons between the two. Did you ever get a chance to interact with Rick Hauck or any of the STS-26 crew following Challenger to lessons learned as a commander, dealing with the media, dealing with management, dealing with whatever that comes with that, I guess, stigma, if you will, of being a return-to-flight mission?
Well, Rick Hauck did call me several times. In fact, when he was in town, we met, we had lunch, we talked quite a bit. I got to know him, and years later, we worked on the NASA Advisory Council together. So that was a good thing that he actually initiated that. So I don't remember everything he said, but back then, the things that he told me helped me with some of the techniques. I think the fact that as a commander of the return to flight mission, I didn't have a very cookie cutter type job description. I pretty much made my own job description, and what meetings do I need to go to? What people do I need to talk to? And you know, I needed some help with that too, because I didn't always know what was going on. A lot of activities that were taking place, for example, there were all around the country. Here in San Antonio, the Southwest Research Institute was doing a study on, well, they actually built a test apparatus, and they fired a piece of foam at a mock-up shuttle wing and blew a hole in it. And that was the smoking gun of the accident. And things like that were taking place around the country, and I really had to take the initiative to go out and find out, you know, what's happening, where do I need to be, where do I need to send my crew, when do we need to train, versus going out and watching these activities or taking part. Some of it we did just for morale. For example, I asked if my crew could go up and help, and this was actually 6 weeks 8 weeks after the accident, if we could go up to East Texas and help with the search for debris. Not a fun thing to do. In fact, some people said, no, you shouldn't be up there. But I said, I think it's important that my crew takes part in this. And it turned out to be the right thing to do because I think it helped those that were doing that dreary job of walking through the woods looking for tiny little pieces of the shuttle that hadn't been found yet. And we talked to them and told them, hey, we support what you're doing and keep up the great work. And we're here to get a little feel for what your day-to-day job is like.
Yeah.
So we were doing things like that. But, you know, no one asked me to do these things. And in some cases, they asked me not to do them. But I thought it was, again, it was important to give us the big picture of what we were doing with our mission, not just return to flight accident recovery, but really bringing the whole country, people working around the country, and even those that are just observing, want the country to have a space program. They want the shuttle to get flying again. Mm-hmm. And we needed to stomp out these stories about the shuttle was going to be canceled.
Right.
I never thought it was going to be canceled. And that was, it turned out to be a common question. I know we're out there. We're supporting the program, and it's going to fly again. And it did.
And now we move forward to get want to get some of your comments about moving forward. Now here we are. The shuttle is done. We have no new replacement. We're relying on Soyuz. There's these, you know, are we in the right direction? Are we heading in the right way? Do we have the right, you know, plans in place? You know, as you look at the future of the space program, certainly the human spaceflight program, what are you telling folks today? What is the message from your perspective as a former astronaut?
Well, I still go out and give talks and try to carry on the message. As far as there, in general, okay, big picture in general, we need to explore. Our country needs to explore. Our planet needs to explore. It, to me, is part of our survival. We can't walk away from it. We can't say, oh, the country has budget problems. We're going to just cut out the space program. Some people actually still suggest that. They're very uninformed, and I try to be kind to these people. I try to give them, you know, direction, things that you can read. But basically, look at history. Countries that are strong and remain strong are countries that explore. Mm-hmm. This applies to the whole planet, too. We've got to continue. It's like investing in research and development. And, you know, if you're a company, and you don't do that, eventually you're going to die. You've got to have new products and do new things. And the other thing, as far as where we're going to go, moon, we were going to go back to the moon, the constellation was canceled, and now we're going to go to the asteroids, or maybe, I support whatever the country decides to do. We need to stop changing our mind, because when we change our mind and we cancel programs, it sets us back years.
And Eileen,
pick something and go there.
And Eileen, stand by right there. Those are great words. We're going to take our quick final break of the day. Come back, check in on the weekly local launch forecast, wrap up our conversations, and talk a little bit more with Eileen Collins. Everybody stand by for this last break. I'm Jim Behnke. You are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Welcome back, everybody. As we do begin this final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, I want to jump right to our local launch forecast because I still have some more questions for Eileen, and we don't want to waste any time. Let you know, by the way, this past week's successful launch of the Atlas V, we do now have somewhat of a break before we will see the next launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. United Launch Alliance has a Delta IV rocket aimed for a launch in May, but no set date announced yet. And we also have an Atlas V launch booked on the Eastern Range for May 15th with a launch time of 5:49 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That particular Atlas mission set to carry another Global Positioning System satellite into orbit. So we have a few weeks to wait before the next launch. They always seem to bunch up the way they do around here. Meanwhile, I should remind you and want to remind you that activity at the International Space Station is pretty busy this week. The Dragon spacecraft that's been docked there for a couple weeks now is scheduled to be unberthed now on Tuesday and re-enter the atmosphere to splash down in the Pacific Ocean. It'll be recovered along with its returning cargo of science experiments and samples. Remember, Dragon, the only spacecraft that can bring stuff back from the station these days. And then later this week, on Thursday at 4:43 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, a Soyuz rocket and spacecraft scheduled to launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with three new crew members destined for the International Space Station. The mission is going to be especially interesting, I think, at least during that first day. Normally, a Soyuz takes about 2 days from launch to docking, the same way the shuttle kind of flew and approached up to the space station. For this launch, they are going to fly a more direct trajectory so that they can dock with the space station just shy of about 6 hours after launch. The Soyuz crew includes two cosmonauts and NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy. So don't tell me we don't fly people, still don't fly people into space. For more information about these and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. We're wrapping up our conversation with Eileen Collins. And Eileen, I'm curious, when you went up, well, I'm sure you had a trainer in Houston, but did you, when you went up to the station, did you have a chance to crawl around inside a Soyuz and see how cramped it was?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. When the shuttle astronauts docked with the station, we pretty much had a chance to, although we only worked in certain segments, we had a chance to view pretty much everything. The Soyuz, at the time I was in it, had a lot of, I would say it had some stowage in there, like some of the suits that they would wear on return and the like. So we did get a chance to train in the Soyuz while we were over in Russia, so that was a good experience.
You think this quick trip from launch to docking is a good idea, given crew comfort?
Personally, I would be in favor of doing a test to see if it was going to work. So I think, you know, it's been a while since I've been there, but back when I left NASA in 2006, I was even in favor of a shorter time for the shuttle to dock with the station.
Sure.
It took us flight up until flight day three, but yeah, it would put a lot more pressure on the crew. And sometimes the crew doesn't always feel healthy when you first get into space. There's some adaptation. So that is the big limitation. But I think that we didn't really have a mission need to get the shuttle docked any sooner. But I think it's a good idea to do the test. But whether or not you can rely on doing that routinely will remain to be seen.
Yeah. It always amazed me, as we learned in the later years of the program, taking those 2 days for everyone to sort of get their space legs, you know, how crazy it must have been in the early days, you know, to fly a 4 or 5 day mission where you're doing an IUS deploy 5 hours after launch. I mean, it just must have been crazy in that cockpit right after achieving orbit. Talking about the future, we talked a little bit about it before the break. Next spacecraft, I'm always curious to ask astronaut pilots this, especially, you know, we're looking at Orion as a Apollo-like capsule. That's not a great way to describe it, but in any case, it doesn't have wings. Next vehicle coming online, would you like to see it have wings? Are we taking a step backward in any way by relying on a ballistic blunt-end body like we're doing?
No, I don't think we're taking a step backward. There's benefits to each design. Without a doubt, you don't ever want to hang a spacecraft low on a rocket launcher again, where it can get hit by debris.
Yeah.
Some of the winged vehicles you see being designed will sit at the top, so that problem is solved. The benefit of having a wing is on entry you have more cross range, meaning you can have a little more flexibility in where you can land, and it's a softer landing, but you pretty much need a runway,
right,
piece of concrete to land on. Coming down in the capsule, and by the way, I support the design idea of the Orion, and I think it seems to be, from what I've watched, that everything seems to be going along
cool. Well.
As an astronaut, I would be feel very safe flying in that type of design. So I think we're doing the right thing, and we're going in the right direction. My only complaint is it's not going fast enough, but there's not a whole lot we can do about that.
That's for sure. It's
coming along.
That's for sure. Okay, Eileen, we're going to do terminal count with you right now. This is this little feature we do here. We're going to ask you 5 questions, get to know you a little bit better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers, okay? So here we go. Coolest rocket.
Okay.
Coolest rocket.
Well, the Saturn V, because it took us out of low Earth orbit.
That's good. We're talking about Wayne Hale. Did you know Wayne Hale's is the Fireball XL5? It's just so classic of him.
Oh.
First launch that you saw or remember?
Well, first... I actually don't. The first launch I remember was during the Gemini program. I was probably in third or fourth grade. The first launch I saw in person was a shuttle launch. I was down there working. It was, I think it was STS-50.
Wow.
1992.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Most prized space memorabilia.
Oh, without a doubt, Amelia Earhart's scarf flew with me in space on my first mission.
Yeah.
I does not belong to me, but it was just the neatest thing.
That is cool. Best space-related TV series or movie?
The best movie, my favorite movie, is Apollo 13, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I don't watch a whole lot of TV, but when I was a kid, I watched Star Trek. And in its time, this was the 1960s, it was a really fabulous, forward-looking TV program.
And we're still waiting for the second movie here. We'll see what JJ does this time around. Last question, Moon, Mars, or beyond? Real quick, Moon, Mars, or beyond?
Beyond.
Yeah. And maybe both those other destinations along the way, perhaps.
How about all three of them?
All three, all of the above. That's great. Eileen, thanks so much for being on the program today. We really appreciate it. We hope to see you down here for the Hall of Fame. And go write a book, would you?
Oh, thanks, Jim. Maybe you can help me.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
Okay.
Thanks, Eileen. Day. Take care now. Okay, there goes Eileen Collins, one of the best, absolutely. Okay, next week is Easter. I plan to take that holiday off, spend some time with the family, so we're going to do a pre-recorded Best of Space Talk for you all to enjoy. Haven't picked out the highlights yet, but I'll do that this weekend. We've had some good moments in the last few weeks, so we hope to repeat some of them. Hope you can have a chance to listen in and enjoy that conversation. That is it for now. For Space Talk is a production of Mindless Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for the program today. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. for a Best of Space Talk edition. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.